Hey, Chloe, do we have a guest today?
You know what? I think we do. And it's Kathy Barnett.
Politics, culture, faith, and so much more. This is Fact of Life with Chloe Noller and Mattingly Watson on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Fact of Life podcast. And thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to have you. We have a fantastic guest today, Bonnie Grace. Please introduce us.
Kathy Barnett is a wife, homeschooling mom, veteran, author, political commentator, and politician from the state of Pennsylvania. Kathy served her country proudly for 10 years in the Armed Forces Reserves, where she was accepted into officer candidacy school. She worked with two major financial firms in corporate America and sat on the board of a pregnancy crisis center for 5 years. In 2020, she authored the book, Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain, Being Black and Conservative in America. As a member of the Republican Party, she ran for the United States House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District in 2020 and sought the party's nomination in the 2022 United States Senate election in Pennsylvania. Additionally, she hosts her own show, The Kathy Barnett Podcast. Most recently, she worked as the National Grassroots Director for Vivek Ramaswamy's presidential campaign. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so glad.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, getting right into it, just ask me, what prompted you to get involved in politics?
Edmund Burke has a quote. The only thing, and I may mess this quote up, but the only thing that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men and women to do nothing. And for far too long, good people have been doing their own thing, living their lives, working, paying bills, raising their children. And we have, at some level, as good people, said, oh, you know, politics, we're just going to leave it to those people, right? And we're going to live our lives. But for far too long, good people have been sitting on the sidelines. And that's the reason why we find ourselves where we are in our culture today, in our country, in politics. And I'm looking around and, you know, there were a series of things that were going on in my own life. And I just looked around and decided, here I am. Use me. And I step forward.
Now, in your book, Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain, Being Black and Conservative in America, you discuss why liberal policies have failed the Black community. What would you say, like, are the liberal policies have become the biggest roadblocks for the Black community? Like, which policies have probably made the Black community suffer the worst?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we could start back with LBJ in the mid-60s and his Great Society idea and creating these slums and projects for subsidized housing for primarily Black people, creating policies that you only get aid if you don't have a husband or a man in the home, which of course incentivizes the Rolling Stone kind of father with Papa was a Rolling Stone kind of syndrome, where you have multiple babies by multiple men because you can't commit to anyone, because if you commit to a man and get married, you're going to get your aid, your subsidies cut. To the government, essentially, I mean, like, in today, what do you really need a man for? In many of these situations, the government will pay your rent. The government will buy your food with food stamps. The government will buy coats for your children, will give you a cell phone, will pay your gas bill, pay your phone bill. What do you really need a man for? In most marriages, I know, is as a result of love and affection for the other partner, but also for financial security. So what do you need a man for when it comes to financial security when the government is your daddy and he will pay for everything? And so there's a lot of incentives where the left says, oh, we're doing this because we care, or we're doing this because we want to help. Stop helping me. You're giving us too much help, right? And that help has really turned into crutches and have decimated the Black community in many regards. And just lastly, let me say one of the, a prevailing narrative from the left is that people who look like me, Black people, that we're victims and that the color of our skin has imprisoned us. And so I can't because of the color of my skin. And so those chains around your brain as well can, get a child, especially if a child, a young child, is growing up in that mentality that somehow they are victims, somehow they are inferior, somehow others see them as inferior, and some are to be feared. That too creates a world in which they live in.
So, we've talked about that a lot, family recently on our podcast a lot, just the importance of marriage and that kind of thing and in conservative values. So just asking you, have you always been conservative?
I've always been conservative. Most Black people, surprise, surprise, are conservative. I certainly grew up conservative. Now, I wasn't a Republican, but I grew up conservative, grew up in the church, grew up, in a family that prized, that put a great emphasis on work ethics and family life. And I remember, in my book, I talk about I was born into the Democrat Party just like I was born into brown skin in that environment. And I remember when I turned 18, I did so much research, so much work. I was so excited to vote for the first time. And I did all the work and I looked at all of the candidates and walked into that booth and just pulled Democrat all the way down because I'm Black. This is just what you do. No one talked to me about it. It's just what you do. And it wasn't until I was a junior in college and I wanted to get involved in politics. And I went to the first Democrat office I saw. I don't know why. He's a Democrat. I walked in and I said, I want to help. And as I'm sitting there, I tell you no lie, it was almost like an audible voice that I heard that asked me, do you even know what he believes? Do you even know if what he believes is what you believe? And I sat there, this man was talking to me. I sat there trying to think, well, what does he believe? What are his policies? Why didn't I look for his policies? Why did I just walk into this man's office and I don't even know what his policies are? Like, what is broken about the way I'm processing information? And the moment he took a breath, I just jumped up and ran out of the room. And that was the beginning of a seed that was planted that, just because I'm Black doesn't mean I have to be a Democrat. And to begin to analyze these policies that are being passed and how those policies actually show up in Black communities. And when I did that, I saw that we were not better off. And it began the pretty rapid process of me leaving the Democrat plantation, voting mixed party, and then eventually just not voting Democrat ever again. And with this party of Democrats, I will never vote Democrat again.
We recently had Stephanie Trussell on the podcast. And
I love her.
She voiced similar sentiments in her story, talking about how she'd always had those conservative values. But then, as she got older, she realized that those conservative values more aligned with the Republican Party than what she had always been told with the Democratic Party. But that being said, what, in your opinion, are the biggest issues facing the Republican Party today?
How much time do we have? I mean, good grief. In many regards, especially when you look at these last several bills that the Republican Party that in the House have passed out of the House, one would begin to think that the Republican Party is behaving a lot like a controlled opposition party and not truly a Republican Party espousing our conservative values, but they're there to give the illusion of a choice, that we have a choice outside of the Democrat Party. But when you look at these two particular bills, the one that they just passed, I think it's about $61 billion you're sending over to Ukraine, and the other one a couple of weeks ago of $1.2 trillion, and none of that money is allocated to anything that we care about. The Gallup poll just put out their annual poll where they assess the top 14 concerns Americans have. So they essentially asked a question, what keeps you up at night, Americans? And the top 10 issues has nothing to do with Ukraine, has nothing to do with funding different wars across the globe, but it was inflation, it was crime, it was violence, it was illegal immigration, the fear of hunger and homelessness. So these last two bills of $1.2 trillion, another bill that had about $61 billion going to Ukraine, none of that money actually addresses the issues of the people. And then when you take into consideration that although it's a slim margin, the House is controlled by Republicans. And then you begin to realize that Democrats could not do half the stuff they're doing if Republicans weren't complicit. So we have a party of quote unquote leaders who are not representing the will of the people or the interests of the people, but they have their own personal agendas and they're more concerned with securing the borders of other countries than securing our own border. So, I mean, I could talk forever just about that lack of awareness. The other thing that I've seen time and time again is that I've never seen a party that has such disdain for their own base of people. And as one who ran in a very competitive race in Pennsylvania and in 2022, and also as the national grassroots director for the Vivek Ramaswamy presidential campaign, I believe I have credibility in saying that a house divided cannot long stand. And we have a party in the Republican Party where our quote unquote leaders have, many of them, not all, but many of them have great disdain for their base. And you see it in these policies. You see it with these two particular bills I just referenced. You see it in how they will not stand up for our values.
You've talked about failures on both sides, both the Republican Party and the Democrat Party, for the people. But you mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy's campaign. How did you get involved in that?
Yeah, it was Vivek. You know, I was the first person he brought onto his team. So it was just Vivek and I for many months before we started bringing on other consultants. But Vivek actually saw me first, and when I was running for U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania in 2022, he saw me on a national debate stage on Newsmax, and I was handling my business, and Vivek saw it. He liked it, and he liked me on Twitter. Then I was getting ready to have my next debate, and I wanted to learn more about ESG. And no one knows that and has exposed ESG for what it is more than Vivek Ramaswamy. And so I got his book, Woke Inc., started reading it, loved it, went to like him on Twitter, saw that he had already liked me. I went into his DM and I said, we need to talk. He DMs me back immediately and says yes, and then sends me his cell phone. We start talking. Next thing I know, I'm in New York with him. I'm at his home spending the weekend with him and his family, and he's just an amazing young man.
Now, we're here on Fact of Life interviewing Kathy Barnett, who was the National Grassroots Director for Vivek Ramaswamy. But, you know, Kathy, you've also had, like you were saying, that political career of your own. And getting into a little bit of policy talk, you've mentioned multiple times on different stages that you're unapologetically pro-life. Have your views been impacted at all through, I know you have a unique experience with your mother. Has that experience of her having you so young impacted those views as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know that what is growing in that womb is a life. Oh, my goodness. I feel like I'm getting emotional. Oh, my goodness. You know, I've told this story so many times, and yet it's my life. And so it is very personal. For me, I've been crying a lot today. What is this? I've been talking at different different points and just get emotional when I start talking about my own personal journey because I was not supposed to be here. And I'm so grateful. For those who don't know my story, I am the byproduct of a rape. My mother was very young. She was 11 years old when I was conceived, and my father was 21. And, you know, my mother didn't have a lot of input in this situation of whether or not I was going to live. But I'm so grateful. I think about my Grandma Hattie and my Grandma Tut and Granddaddy Chalk, and I'm so grateful for these adults. I remember once seeing my grandmother sign her name, and she did it with an X. So she wasn't, by our standards today, a very learned person. And yes, she knew enough to know that what was growing in my mother's womb was a life, was something that was valuable, something that was worth protecting. And I'm so grateful to them when I think about them. And I think about, you know, we didn't have a lot, but I didn't know it. I was actually an adult before I realized just how poor and dire our situation was. But I grew up feeling loved. I grew up feeling protected. And so when I see us having this conversation today, one, I'm grateful that we're having this conversation about life. I think it's good. I think more conversation, not less. And that is what is also so disturbing about the Republican Party, because, you know, we have a platform of wanting to protect life, and yet we don't want to talk about it. We abdicate the narrative to the Democrats to talk about it. But we should be talking about it. Life is a beautiful thing. And I'm grateful that, one, we're having this conversation, but also, you know, I have no exceptions to the rule. I'm a byproduct of rape. I don't believe that a baby, I had nothing to do with how I was conceived. I was an innocent bystander in all of that. So why burden me with the consequences that squarely belongs to the one who assaulted my mother? Why should I have to carry that burden? And then it's so short-sighted, abortion, in the case of a rape, for example, because murdering me would not have undone the wrong that had been committed to my mother. So getting rid of me would not have solved that my mother was violated. I have never glorified how I was conceived, but I'm grateful to God that I'm here. I'm grateful to God that from me has come a wonderful marriage to an amazing man and two amazing children who, if you follow real science, you know that that would not have happened. And then lastly, again, it's so, abortion is so short-sighted in the event of a rape, because when my mother was raped at such a young age, the path of her life changed, and my mother has suffered greatly over the years. You know, the pathology that comes along with being violated at such a young age. And today, wanting to be sensitive to my mother, but she has gone through her own journey. And it was me who have been there to provide a net to catch my mother and to bring her to a place where she is better and healthier and able to function. Now, what if I wasn't there? Who would be there to catch my mother? So again, this is a multifaceted conversation that we should be having, and we should be leading in the conversation, not hiding, not ducking and hiding, hoping Democrats don't run on this issue. We know they're going to run on this issue. They have no other issue to run on. So of course they're going to run on this issue. And we too should be running on our values and using stories like mine and others to humanize that baby and to really fight for that unborn.
So something that we really like to talk about on this podcast and encourages is young women who are looking to the future and and looking at what they want to do in the future. And I think our culture loves to tell you that you either have two options. You can be a traditional mom and stay at home and be a wife, and or you can go and have a career and make a lot of money, and you know, and you were mentioning earlier, like, you don't need to get married. You can survive on your own as a woman. And so
I don't believe that. However.
No.
Okay.
There's a caveat here. Okay, yes. Absolutely. And so I guess I would ask you, like, what would your message be to women who think that and think they have two options? And, you know, for these women that want to have a family and want to be a mom, yeah, but, you know, do feel called to serve in politics maybe, or, you know, are given gifts of, you know, exceptional speaking abilities and communication abilities and have this desire to serve the community. How do you balance those things, and how have you done that? And what would your encouragement be?
Oh my goodness, the balance. We're always looking for balance. I don't think there is such a thing. Balance. What I find is that whatever I am doing in the moment, I'm giving it my all in the moment, as much as I can possibly give. So if I'm with my children and my husband, I'm, you know, the phone is off, the TV is off, I'm just spending time with them. If I'm in the world of politics or my job or on the radio or whatever it is that I'm doing, I'm trying to be the best that I can possibly be. Now, with that being said, allow me to say that before I got into the world of politics, I was a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm. And I left, you know, I mean, prior to having my first son, my first child, which is my son, you know, I was going to take over corporate America. I mean, I'm like, I'm going to do this thing. And then I had this bundle of joy, this little baby. And I'm looking at him, and in order to be at the top of my game, that meant spending 11, 12, 13 hours at work, which meant my son was spending 11, 12, 13 hours with someone else. And then I would pick him up from daycare, and maybe I had 2 good hours with him, right, to feed him, to bathe him, to read a book to him, to put him in bed, and then the cycle repeated again. And I began to realize very early on, within a couple of months of him being born, someone else is raising my child. Someone else is giving my baby his values. And I believe that that is something my husband and I should do. And so it became very obvious to me, and I'm grateful for a husband that would agree, that I wanted to come out of corporate America, come out of the workforce, so that I can be home with my child, who, I mean, maybe he was a year, I can't remember, maybe it was a year, maybe about 12 months, I'm sorry, maybe about 14 months when I came out. But now I'm pregnant with our second child. And so I stepped back. And the goal was that I would only do this until they were ready to start public school. And then as soon as my daughter turned 5 years old and now she can go to public school, I'm thinking, great, now I can get my life back. I looked forward to that little yellow bus driving off with my children, and I could spend 8 hours focused on me and what I want to do. And, you know, I am woman, hear me roar and all of that stuff. And at this point, now my daughter's 5 years old. I enroll her into kindergarten, and she comes home with this stack of paperwork that most kids come home with on the first day. And I'm thumbing through it, and I noticed that my five-year-old has a guidance counselor. And I'm thinking to myself, what does my five-year-old have a guidance counselor for? I mean, I had a guidance counselor in high school. Mm-hmm. Like, do you want to go to college? You want to go to trade school? You want to take the ACT, the SAT? Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there thinking, what is this guidance counselor guiding my five-year-old on? So I emailed the guidance counselor. I asked for her teaching objectives, and it was 35 of the most ridiculous things. I don't know why I remember, but number 5 was to teach my five-year-old the difference between the truth and a lie. And I'm thinking to myself, what rubrics is she going to use? Because most adults I know can't distinguish between the truth and a lie. So what rubrics are you going to use to teach it to my five-year-old? Number 35 was going to come home with a permission slip because they're going to be talking about little boy body parts and little girl body parts. But number 15 was the one that really stuck out to me because it was going to teach my five-year-old how to recognize and respect different family configurations, which is buzzword for same-sex marriage at the time, right? We weren't dealing with transgenderism of all things, but at that time it was just same-sex marriage. So I set up an appointment. I go talk to the guidance counselor, and I'm like, show me what you're going to take into my daughter's room to teach her how to recognize and respect family, different family configurations. And it was beautifully illustrated books of Billy going to his father's home, and his father's boyfriend Henry was there, Sally with her two moms, some divorced couple. And as I'm talking to this guidance counselor, she says she had been teaching it for 8 years and no parent had ever asked her anything about it.
Wow.
But I can tell she seemed like a nice person, like a nice, like I would like this person. Mm-hmm. But I can also tell she wouldn't have the guts to come up to me as an adult on the street and have this conversation. But you're willing to go stand in front of my five-year-old and act like a subject matter expert on this issue. Mm-hmm. So I started getting a little heated, right? Because I do have the nerve to walk up to a stranger and have this conversation. But I know what it takes to be that person who would be willing to walk up to complete strangers and say, you know, there's only two genders, right? And everything else is a mental health crisis. But I could tell she would never do that. But now I'm getting a little heated that you're walking in front of my daughter like you are that person. And as I was leaving, a couple of other things happened. But as I was leaving, the thought came to me, either I am going to fight tooth and nail, and this is 10 years ago, mind you, where no one was talking about these things. I would be the only parent at the school board talking about this. I can either go down that route or we can homeschool our kids. And so although I wanted to get back out there again, I recognized that my first priority was to make sure that my babies were not going to be confused, were not, that their innocence was not going to be hijacked. And although I, you know, I wanted, you know, my career, as you read off my bio, I've been an adjunct professor in corporate America in the financial industry. I've done a lot of things with my life, and yet I recognize I'm going to have to wait it out a little bit longer. And what's so amazing about God is that he redeems the time, because look at what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I would have never thought I would be doing this, but this is exactly what I've been made to do, and I'm very grateful for it. So family first, have children. I wished I had more kids. But we didn't, so I'm grateful for what we have. But know that there is no such thing as balance. You're going to figure it out. Today, my babies are 15 and 18, so they're still my babies. They still need a mommy and daddy, probably more so now than ever before. And yet, my husband and I, we are holding on tightly. They're really good, and we're managing that out.
Thank you so much. Your words are absolutely beautiful, like very inspiring. But thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
The Fact of Life podcast can be found at Fact of Life Podcast on Instagram or at Fact of Life Pod on Twitter. Reach out to the host at factoflifepodcast@gmail.com or send a message on Instagram or Twitter. Listen to The Fact of Life anywhere you get your podcasts, especially right here on Radio Free Hillsdale, 101.7 FM. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on The Fact of Life.